You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, I hope you'll spread the word about Kick-Ass News and share us with at least two friends this week. Or better yet, share Kick-Ass News with all your friends on Facebook or Twitter. And if you really want to help, donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews. Thanks for listening, and now enjoy the podcast.
We are here to build, to protect, to support the civilian population. To that end, we must avoid killing it at all costs.
We can't help them and kill them at the same time. It just ain't humanly possible.
Now.
SWAR's been running 8 years now. Given your reputation and your formidable drive, our hope is that you're the man who will get the job done.
Most of us here will know General McMahon as the man who kicked Al-Qaeda in the sack.
You're welcome.
Get your troops in order. Move the needle a little bit. Show everyone a nice looking set of graphs.
Just finish this thing.
It's a lost cause.
We can stay in Afghanistan forever.
That's why I'm gonna win it. My team and I are about to embark on a new direction.
What is this new direction?
We build Afghanistan into a free and prosperous nation.
All right, smile for the cameras, Glenn.
Sounds a lot like the old direction.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was a preview of the new Netflix original film, War Machine. Based on Michael Hastings' book, The Operators, the wild and terrifying inside story of America's war in Afghanistan, War Machine recreates a U.S. general's roller coaster rise and fall as part reality, part savage parody, raising the specter of just where the line between them lies today. At the story's core is Brad Pitt's sly take on a successful, charismatic four-star general, loosely based on Stanley McChrystal, who leapt in like a rock star to command coalition forces in Afghanistan, only to be taken down by his own hubris and a journalist's no-holds-barred exposé. It's written and directed by my guest today, Australian filmmaker David Michaud. Michaud's debut feature film was the critically acclaimed crime drama Animal Kingdom, which won the World Cinema Grand Jury Prize at the 2010 Sundance Film Festival and went on to win 10 Australian Film Institute Awards, including Best Film, Best Direction, and Best Original Screenplay. Animal Kingdom was also named Best First Film by the New York Film Critics Circle and earned Academy Award and Golden Globe nominations for Best Supporting Actress Jackie Weaver. Michaud co-wrote the feature film Hesher, starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Natalie Portman, which also debuted at the 2010 Sundance Festival. And he wrote and directed The Rover, starring Guy Pearce and Robert Pattinson, which screened as an official selection of the 2014 Cannes Film Festival. Today, David Michaud will talk about adapting Michael Hastings' book, The Operators, for the screen, his decision to fictionalize the character based on General Stanley McChrystal, and how the war machine itself becomes a character in his film. He'll discuss the flawed thinking behind counterinsurgency, the irony of trying to win over the hearts and minds of the same people you're shooting at, and the danger of leaders making decisions within a bubble. Plus, we talk about Sir Ben Kingsley's foppish portrayal of Hamid Karzai, Brad Pitt's power walk, and why no one grows cotton in Afghanistan. Coming up with filmmaker David Michaud in just a moment. David Michaud is the writer-director behind the critically acclaimed crime film Animal Kingdom and the futuristic western The Rover. His latest is an ambitious military satire starring Brad Pitt called War Machine. It debuts on Netflix and in theaters on Friday, May 26th. David, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I enjoyed your film, and it's based on Michael Hastings' book, The Operators, about General Stanley McChrystal and the U.S. war in Afghanistan. Now, in the film version, you've retitled it War Machine. Is that an allusion to the military-industrial complex, or what are you trying to say about how this massive military structure operates with that title?
Yeah, very much so. You know, Michael Hastings' book was called The Operators, and as soon as I started picturing the film that I imagined I might build out of this world, I knew that what I wanted to do was make a film that was about more than just one particular general or one general and his little bunch of guys, his entourage. I wanted to make a film that was about a much larger system, about a much larger institution, and not just that institution in itself, you know, not just the various layers of the military, but the ways in which that institution interacts with the civilian world and with the media. And so, yeah, it is basically an allusion to the larger military-industrial complex.
Yeah, and the media does play a big part in this because, again, this is fairly closely based on General Stanley McChrystal, who courted a lot of media attention, went on 60 Minutes, and had the Rolling Stone piece, which eventually undid his career. Talk a little about the role of the media in military conflicts and that relationship.
Well, it's a complex one. I think one of the experiences that the military had, for instance, you know, during and immediately after the Vietnam War, was getting a clear sense of how opening that war up to public and media scrutiny possibly hindered their objectives, which weren't necessarily our objectives. Next cab off the rank in a way was the 1991 Gulf War, which was almost completely shut down from a media perspective. You know, from my memory of it was just, you know, some distant shots of rockets exploding in Baghdad and cameras attached to missiles as they went down chimneys, but virtually nothing else. And I think when these new theaters of war, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, started happening, you could feel a much more orchestrated sense of the military co-opting the media into its larger enterprise for better and worse. You know, we had a much clearer picture of what was going on, and yet at the same time, you could feel the ways in which journalists were almost forcibly compromised in their engagement with, you know, when you embed with a military unit, it's almost impossible not to feel an obligation to have as your guiding principle respect for those people. You know, and I think one of the things that made what Michael Hastings did in both his Rolling Stone story and the book so unusual was that on some level for those people, he seemed to violate that understanding, right, even though everything he reported was true, you know.
Yeah, but he also approached it as an outsider who wasn't really a military embedded reporter. He was reporting for Rolling Stone, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, all these embedded reporters come from some outside, you know, news organization,
right,
generally speaking. I mean, and
but
it
not
was
part
and
of the Washington political scene.
No. I mean, he was writing for Rolling Stone, and I'm not quite sure what they expected was going to happen. But, you know, there is that he was invited in to the inner circle of, you know, a four-star general running a conflict, his responsibility was to report on that experience truthfully, you know, what's shocking to me is that him doing that was in a way considered unusual.
And the original book, The Operators, was a nonfiction book about Stanley McChrystal and the war in Afghanistan. But in the film, you change him to a character named General Glenn McMahon. You also have characters who are pretty obviously based on Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Michael Flynn, but not called by those names. Was the decision to fictionalize certain characters a legal decision on behalf of Netflix, or was it a creative decision to give you the freedom to take a little bit more creative license with the story?
Yeah, it was entirely a creative decision. Okay. I mean, I know once I'd, you know, the draft had been put through the Netflix legal machine, as happens on any film, you know, they came back to us and said, look, you, just so you know, you don't have to change these names if you don't want to. I made the decision very early on that I wanted to do this, in part for the creative wiggle room it would allow me, but also because I didn't want this film to be about, I certainly didn't want it to be a Stan McChrystal biopic. You know, I didn't want these guys, for instance, and the events of this story to seem like some kind of crazy, reckless aberration. You know, mm-hmm. For me, the movie was about a much larger system, and that what it has to say applies equally to everything that preceded the events of this movie and presumably everything that would follow.
That's interesting because the war machine itself, as you said, is something of a character in this movie. And you drive that home in the final scene when General McMahon gets sacked and you see yet another badass general who could probably be a carbon copy of him swaggering in to take his place.
Yeah. I mean, it's like this kind of this revolving door of powerful and ambitious men climbing a ladder and falling off the top. And then the mm-hmm. next one makes it to the top and then he falls over, you know, and it's at some point, you would expect someone climbing that ladder to stop and say, hang on a minute, everyone who seems to get to the top just falls to their deaths. You know what I mean? At what point do you start questioning the ladder itself?
Yeah. And the character of General McMahon seems to be sort of reminiscent of a General Patton or General MacArthur and somewhat out of place in the modern age of asymmetrical warfare. The current president, Donald Trump, constantly cites guys like Patton and MacArthur as exactly the kind of leaders he wants running our military. Is there something of a cautionary tale in this film against putting an old-fashioned World War II-style ass-kicker in charge of the military?
You know, to a certain extent, for me, the movie is very much about detachment. It's mm-hmm. you know, it's at first about delusion and about the detachment that comes as a consequence of that delusion, detachment of the military executive level from what's going on the ground and the detachment of the military top brass from its civilian executive. In order to amplify that delusion, you know, we decided to play with like almost absurd hubris.
Mm-hmm.
The modern general presents as a kind of quite bookish, staid, measured.
Right, West Point.
You know, yeah, yeah. A tertiary educated mm-hmm. thinker. Brad and I were of the belief, though, that, you know, it's as would be inevitable of any of these guys who had grown up with military aspirations, that somewhere deep inside they see themselves as sitting in a lineage of great American military commanders that stretches back to mm-hmm. MacArthur and Patton, and that so that somewhere deep inside them that guy lives. We just made the decision to let that guy kind of bust his way out and be the kind of the giant anachronism that Brad's character has become.
Yeah, and a moment ago you mentioned the tonal shift in the film. It starts out as sort of an irreverent portrayal of the people at the top of the command chain while showing in a very serious way the sacrifices and moral quandaries our soldiers find themselves in. Do you think typical war films are a little too hesitant to portray that chasm between the brass who make the decisions and the soldiers tasked with carrying them out?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I was first contemplating a movie set in, you know, one of these contemporary theaters of war, I think I had originally assumed that I would probably make something that was just about the experience of the battlefield. A principal reason for my resistance to that was that, you know, it felt to me like all films about these contemporary theaters are that kind of film. Mm-hmm. And I started to wonder why it was that, you know, despite America's long and rich history of war satire, stretching all the way back, you know, to Catch 22 and MASH and
right.
and Strange Love, and you know, where have those movies gone? Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a coincidence that they aren't a part of the cinema vernacular today. Mm-hmm. I think it has something very much to do with how separated society has become from its military institutions, that you could suggest that our way of assuaging our feelings of guilt with regard to our separation from our militaries is to treat the entire institution, this gigantic institution, with nothing other than deference and mm-hmm. reverence, you know. And I think we do a disservice to those men and women who are actually on the ground by not asking very probing questions of the architects of the chaos that they endure.
Yeah, and I want to talk about Brad Pitt's character in this, because you go very big with his character. I think you capture it just right, but it's certainly a thin line that he's walking in his character as General McMahon. Did you and Brad have to be ever cautious of crossing that line from satire into parody or outright farce?
No, I mean, I don't know, because I don't know. I don't feel like we would tread that. I don't feel like we were treading a line, you know, mm-hmm. in a way. It's like it pretty much goes straight into that territory. I mean, it is, mm-hmm. it's a big performance.
Right.
I mean, I love it because it's so wild. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that I knew that, you know, the movie was on some level going to be about detachment, I wanted that detachment to be felt in a very pronounced way. You know, mm-hmm. I wanted the movie to feel tonally nuts. The way to do that was to let Brad off the leash, you know, let that yeah. world of his character and the guys around him be ridiculous in its hubris and its delusion and its bravado and all that kind of stuff. And then to treat the experience of the Marines on the ground actually very seriously. As much as I started to see a much larger movie that would work in the world of satire, you know, about the absurdity of war, it felt that it would be improper. It felt to me like it would be improper not to let the movie somehow find its ultimate home in horror and sadness.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the challenge, the line that I was treading wasn't so much in calibration of Brad's performance. We knew from the outset that we were just going to go big with this thing. You know, he was going to be channeling Sterling Hayden and George C. Scott. And the challenge was in the balancing of those two different tones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have to ask, Brad Pitt as General McMahon has this really strange gait when he's walking or running. It's like the top half of his body doesn't move, as if he's like a Ken doll from the waist up. His arms are stuck out. Where did General McMahon's walk come from?
Well, I mean, I guess you should probably ask Brad, but I mean, in a way it was, you know, that way that he holds himself speaks mm-hmm. to me of just of rigidity, mm-hmm. of an unbending, just a way of carrying yourself in the world. I remember I'm going to go off on a little tangent here. I watched a documentary recently about a guy named Richie McCaw, who mm-hmm. was the captain of the All Blacks, the New Zealand rugby union team, possibly one of the greatest sporting teams to ever walk the face of the earth. This guy was a titan, and he in this documentary talked about how, you know, he was the captain of the team, and from a very early age he made a decision to carry himself in a way that projected size. He knew he was going to be the his dream was to be the captain of the All Blacks, and he knew that if he was going to do that, when he was on the field he needed to project a certain stature.
Mm-hmm.
And even though Brad and I never talked about the All Blacks, you know, I could see the same thing at
play.
I could see him projecting a kind of not just a rigidity, but a size in the room.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more with director writer David Michaud when we come back in just a moment. When our phones are our very own tailor-made media universes, and our social media feeds are seeded with opinions and lies, how can we possibly find common ground? Especially when our politicians are getting more entrenched by the day. Thankfully, there is one way to maintain a level of frankness and transparency in your media. Listen to On the Media, WNYC's weekly investigation into how the media shapes our worldview. While maintaining the civility and fairness that are hallmarks of public radio, the team at On the Media tackles sticky issues and untangles this era's most intractable questions. Brooke Gladstone and Bob Garfield are your hosts on a search for the truth in a 24-hour news cycle. Catch them on their weekly podcast, On the Media, on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And now, back to the show. Pitt's character arrives in Afghanistan much like General McChrystal, on the heels of having successfully subdued the counterinsurgency in Iraq. What were the higher-ups expecting him to do when he took over as commander of ISAF in Afghanistan?
I don't know that they even knew. You know, yeah. It's that, you know, I mean, I feel like we all deep down know where Obama's sentiments probably lay. You know, he was elected on the promise of pulling American troops out of Iraq, which he did. But in order to do that, you know, being a Democrat, being a first, you know, being a young man, and being a young man with no military experience, he was kind of almost by default forced to project his bullishness on war, you know, to pretend that Afghanistan was a much more important war that needed to be fought and won, you know. But I think really what they wanted was just to find a way of ending it, because it was just as absurdly unwinnable as Iraq, you know, was and is. I think civilian leaders are often very easily bamboozled by military jargon, you know. When a high-ranking general, both inside and outside the administration, comes to them and says, this is what we need in order to win, it can be very difficult for a civilian leader to say, to push back. Because to push back is to appear to be either weak or to be not supporting the fighting men and women. In some ways, it's easier to acquiesce to requests for more troops, because to not do so is to pick a fight with this military institution to which we defer, you know. And so it's like I feel like you could see all of that playing out with the Obama administration during, you know, that time when the events of this movie are kind of taking place, that they just basically want to end it but don't know how to demand of their military leaders that they do so.
Yeah, they say that this war is unwinnable several times throughout the movie, and all he's expected to do is just move the needle enough so that he can claim progress and they can get out of there, basically. One of the funny things in here is that he's warned at first, don't ask for more troops, and that ends up being the first thing that he does is ask the president for 40,000 more troops.
Well, these guys want to win, you know. I mean, they live in a culture of the metric for success is victory and defeat. None of these guys, when they climb to the top of the ladder, want to be the one who gets there, can see over the top, and then says, "Oh, look, no, this isn't doable. Let's just go home."
Yeah.
They all want to be the guy who writes for themselves a page in the history books. And in the absence of any clear actual strategy, especially if what you're talking about is something as kind of as ludicrously delusional as counterinsurgency, of these nation-building hearts and minds exercises, the only way to do it is to just ask for manpower, you know, as if that hasn't already been tried and as if it hasn't failed on innumerable occasions, you know, stretching back decades in various theaters, you know.
Yeah, and General McMahon's plan is based on something called the COIN strategy. What is that?
COIN is just, you know, again, the military is obsessed with acronyms, you know, abbreviations and acronyms. COIN is counterinsurgency. You know, it's one of the things that makes this film kind of politically complex, and it made the making of it a kind of precarious high wire act. Is that on paper, counterinsurgency looks like a noble endeavor? You know, it's taking liberal
campaign.
Democracy to the poor and impoverished of the world, and you know, building liberal democratic institutions, and providing security and peace. And but what seems to go unacknowledged at every turn is the idea that you're almost invariably you're trying to inject this stuff in a gigantic rush into a place that has been decimated by war and conflict. And you're doing it yourself with the most powerful and intimidating military apparatus that has ever existed on the face of the earth. You know, you're basically having to try and convince people that you're there to help them at gunpoint.
The thing of this movie is General McMahon is not unaware of this to some extent, and he says, at least at several points in the film, he at least acknowledges the irony of trying to win over a country at the same time that you're trying to occupy it and shooting at their people. I think it says a lot about good intentions paired with misguided execution.
Yeah, I mean, it's always important to me that I not paint a picture of a four-star general who is just an idiot, you know? I think what you're witnessing in this movie, in this man in this movie, is a kind of desperation. A desperation to leave a meaningful mark on an endeavor that was always doomed to fail. You know, and so what you're looking at almost at every turn is him trying to, or not even attempting to reconcile the irreconcilable. How do you take, you know, an American military that has gotten incredibly efficient at killing and destroying and turn it into a peace and compassion project? It's unsurprising that what you're left with at every turn is confusion.
Now, one of the few people whose name you didn't change in the film was former Afghan President Hamid Karzai, brilliantly played by the great Sir Ben Kingsley. Karzai has an almost foppish indifference to General McMahon's plan and the war in Afghanistan. How do you think Karzai viewed the U.S. strategy to turn around Afghanistan and his role in it?
Well, the two names that I've kept in the film are Karzai and Obama, just to plant, you know, kind of historical flags into the into the ground of the movie. I wouldn't suggest on any level that the character of Karzai that we've created is a wholly accurate representation of the real Hamid Karzai.
But he was certainly rumored to be very corrupt and.
There are all sorts of rumors of corruption floating around, which are probably reflective of just the way, you know, Afghan culture has functioned for centuries. He was also, you know, there is an element of seeming indifference in Sir Ben's performance of the character. I certainly don't know that was true of the real Hamid Karzai. I mean, Hamid Karzai in many ways was put into an incredibly untenable situation, you know, made the leader of a broken country, trying to win the support of its people in concert with this American war machine, and yet almost every day having to explain to the people of that country, having to apologize for yet another kind of horrific civilian casualty situation or something. The indifference I think you can see in Sir Ben's performance is that one that's like, you know, I mean, there's just a couple of very key scenes, and they are, I think what you're looking at more isn't so much his attitude to the job he has as leader of his country. It's more a very specific way that he interacts with this particular American general.
Yeah, and they reference in the film that he may or may not be on drugs and his brother is probably a criminal warlord. The whole economy of the country is basically propped up on heroin. There's a great scene where McMahon is asking, you know, can't they grow anything other than heroin so they can get on their feet? They say that, well, you know, they can grow cotton here. And he says, well, why don't they grow cotton? Apparently because Congress says that they won't put the development money toward anything that would compete with U.S. farmers.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it all speaks to this kind of paternalism that can be incredibly, not just in itself delusional, but can be actually damaging for the country that supposedly is being helped. You know, it's like this an incredible flood of American money into a country like Afghanistan can actually do more harm than good. You know, it can have an adverse effect on inflation. It can completely distort the basic pillars of an economy. And it almost by necessity makes corruption endemic. You know, it's impossible to flood a country with that kind of money and expect everyone not to be somehow tempted by the power and influence it affords. You know, I mean, you end up with it's such the phenomenal waste of American taxpayers' money. I mean, so much of this money floods into Afghanistan, is there for probably a couple of days, and then ends up in a suitcase at Dubai airport on its way to someone's bank account. I mean, it's just, it's madness.
I wonder, why do you suppose President Obama didn't meet with the real-life Stan McChrystal or the fictional General McMahon?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm going to say I don't know. I mean, you know, oh, yeah. I can hypothesize.
That's a fair answer. Again, I mean, one would think that would be important if he has a guy who's in charge of an entire war and we're sending soldiers there. It does strike one as strange or sort of an elephant in the room that the president would seem somewhat detached from the person in charge.
Well,
or
you know,
is that
he,
just a personality thing? A personality
I don't
conflict?
Know. I mean, I can imagine, you know, I can imagine that, you know, Obama thinking that, you know, he has a national security council. He has
right.
people around him
right.
whose job it is to manage this stuff. Mm. That, you know, that conversation that he might have with Stan McChrystal is like, what is that conversation? What is he, mm-hmm. what is he learning necessarily from that? He hasn't employed some very, very, very capable and experienced people to, you know, he's the president, yeah. he's the leader of the free world. He's yeah. a busy man, you know, when you consider that, you know, after however many years it was then, 8 or 9 years, that it was a war that was in a form of stalemate. The question is, how do we end this?
General McMahon in the film is insulated by this bubble of buddies and yes men who seem to be there for no other purpose than to boost his ego. Do you want the audience to see McMahon's bubble and the consequences of that kind of inner circle and perhaps draw parallels and maybe even warnings about the kind of bubble that President Trump seems to have formed around himself?
I certainly think you can draw parallels. I wouldn't call it a warning. I mean, I think we should already be heeding this warning. And there are certain ways in which the character that Brad plays in the film is he's like Bono, you know, he's like a rock star on tour, and he has around him an entire kind of machine that is not just stroking his ego, but propping up the delusion and fortifying it from anything that might upset that apple cart, you know. And I think I would hope that, you know, yes, the most obvious parallel to be drawn is the one between that and the current White House administration. But, you know, I feel like I need to protect myself from that stuff as well. You know, I get I'm sometimes going on these, you know, press tours and blah, blah, blah. And you've always got, you know, you always have people fussing around you and fussing over you and
entourage
and keeping you motivated and feeding you the information you want to hear, but withholding the negative stuff that might throw you off kilter. And you know, I can only imagine what it would be like for those people who are in positions of incredible power. You know?
Yeah, I have to think that can really mess with your work as a director. If you're too insulated and don't have some kind of differing opinions and different perspectives.
Well, no, I mean, I understand it though. It's like, you know, you need to do it. That's why I endeavor. I remember when my first movie came out, I wanted to know to the extent that I felt like I was making movies because I wanted to feel like I was interacting with the culture in some way. You know, one of the first things I did when the movie came out was start, you know, like basically Googling myself, you know, I just wanted to know how was this movie landing in the world, you know, was it bouncing back at me?
Yeah.
Didn't take me long to work out that that's not a very healthy thing to do, you know.
Now you do sound like Donald Trump, going to see what Fox News is saying about you or what the people on Twitter are saying.
I used to be Donald Trump, but now I'm not. But no, the opposite end of that spectrum is, you know, it's like it's to not where I am now, which has its own dangers, which is to, you know, say I have absolutely no engagement with social media, try not to read, you know, or I do it with squinting through one eye just to get a just get a sense of how something's landing. But, you know, I think it's in some ways it's important to just take a good hard look at the ugly, because, you know, what doesn't kill you only makes you stronger.
Well, I really liked the film. I highly recommend it. Again, War Machine debuts on Netflix and in theaters on Friday, May 26. David Michaud, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Thanks again to David Michaud for joining me on the podcast. You can see his film War Machine, starring Brad Pitt, on Netflix and in theaters starting tomorrow, Friday, May 26th. For more information, visit Netflix.com. And just a reminder that On the Media is WNYC Studios' weekly podcast investigating how the media shape our worldview. Hosts Brooke Gladstone and Bob Garfield are here to offer help if you, like them, are questioning the very nature of our reality. In a political and cultural moment so nerve-wracking, On the Media provides a weekly dose of sanity. Get On the Media on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/KickAssNews or click on the donate button at KickAssNews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.